Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Jace Mohm, author of the award-winning book, Globalizing Automobilism, Exuberance and the Emergence of Layered Mobility. Jace, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for inviting me to take part in this New Books Network interview.
Well, it was our pleasure. Thank you for accepting our invitation. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay. I have a double academic background. I started as a literary historian and got a master's degree in that. But after that, that was during the student movement in my native city in the Netherlands. And during that era, I had my first car driving experience. I don't know whether you have the same experience, but I think many people do. And I was totally taken aback by the enormous multiplication of my foot pressure resulting in the drive of a nearly one-ton vehicle. So that was fascinating to me, and it more or less incited me to study technology and car technology. So I decided first to become an automotive mechanic, following auto mechanics courses, and then decided to go to a polytechnic of automotive technology in the Netherlands and got an engineering degree. So this double background more or less shaped the way I think about cars and about mobility. As a result of that, I first worked for a while in Paris, France, at Renault, developing, a very, very, very modest role in developing an engine. I was specialized in engine technology. And later, I became a freelance publicist and translator of car buff books, and following car technology conferences and reporting on that in the Dutch and Belgian engineering press. And after that, they invited me to become a professor of engine technology at the same polytechnic where I studied, and teaching car engine technology. And it was in that position in the late 1980s that this electric vehicle buzz came up. And to be honest, I thought this electric vehicle, will that be a kind of threat to my profession? So, and I decided to study the history of the electric vehicle, and that became the topic of my dissertation at Eindhoven University of Technology. And so this first book that was published in a translated version in 2004 asked the question, why did the electric vehicle constantly fail since its seemingly successful start in the late 19th century and early 20th century? So that more or less started my publication career, so to say. And on the basis of that, I became a professor at Eindhoven University of Technology decided to, as the conclusion of my dissertation was that the electric vehicle did not fail because of technological factors, as many people would have it, but mostly because of cultural factors, because many people at the time in the early 20th century considered the electric vehicle not as a real car. I decided to study that so-called real car and ask myself, so if the electric vehicle failed because of that, perhaps I should try to find out why the competition, the internal combustion engine car, was so successful. And that led to the publication of my first monograph of Western automobilism called Atlantic Automobilism, where I coined the concept of the adventure machine. That was my answer to my initial question. The internal combustion engine car was so successful because it promised the potential motorist a kind of adventure in three aspects: in speed, racing, in space, touring, and even in function, tinkering. So this triple adventure more or less accompanied the early history of the automobile. And in that book, I also could question two what I called master narratives of the traditional history of the automobile. And these two master narratives are first the toy to tool thesis, that the success of the car can be explained because first it was a toy for the rich, and then it became a tool for the middle classes, and I refuted that thesis, claiming that even if the car became a bit utilitarian, it still feeds on the thrill of driving. My second point was that I refuted the thesis of the US as a model of car history. That is also what you see around you in many histories of national car cultures, where more or less the US is used as a kind of a template to write that history. And in my book, I wrote a history of Western automobilism in which I distinguished between two large cultures, an American one and clearly a real European one.
And that brings us to this book, because one of the things you do in it is you expand your focus away from the Atlantic paradigm of Western car and Western mobilism to discussing it on a more global level. What led you to undertake this book, and what determined where you would go from your last work?
It's an interesting question, because I could have stopped at there and said, well, now I have made my point and I go to other topics. But something kept nagging me, and that was that I was describing a kind of culture of only a minority of the world population. And it was only later that I realized that. And the reason that I realized that was that I was applying for a project subsidy at a European scale, a big amount of money. I was rejected, by the way, but from my university, I got a kind of consolation prize, quite substantial, which enabled me to travel and organize workshops in beyond Europe, so to speak, in South America and especially in Asia. And it was there that I realized that, you know, as long as you write a kind of westernized, if I may say so, westernized form of automobile culture history, then you miss the majority of the population in the world. And if you try to write a history from their perspective, it might be quite different. You get a different story. So in that sense, the book we are discussing here, Globalizing Automobilism, is a kind of answer to my first book, Atlantic Automobilism. It's also the first of two volumes, which I would call a kind of world history of car culture. And as such, it is a kind of intermediary volume between an Atlantic car culture book and the third book, of which I am currently proofreading the proofs. The third book is called Pacific Automobilism. So this book more or less analyzes the process in which the car culture is transferred from a purely westernized form into a global form, which I then call a Pacific, because of the shift in emphasis between the Western and a non-Western perspective on car culture.
Part of that broadening that you describe is a broadening not just of the geographic focus of your book, but also the whole notion of mobility. And that's one of the things that I was fascinated by when I was reading your book, about how you point out how to talk just about the automobile ignores a lot of factors that mattered when you're talking about the non-Western world, and how there is, in fact, this broader mobility, maybe revolution's too strong a word, but evolution, where you're seeing bicycles. The one that particularly fascinated me, because I had not read anything about it, was rickshaws, the development of electric trams and so forth, and how this is integral to the story of the expansion of automobilism, you know, globally. I was wondering if you could start us off by talking about global mobility, how you chose develop your analysis of it, and why it was that you felt that the story really was incomplete without including those elements as well.
I could have, you can conceive a world mobility history by writing histories of, let's say, continental car cultures, and then repeat more or less what I had done in my Atlantic Automobilism book. Most scholars of car culture and mobility culture probably will fall into that trap, I would say. I did, fell also in that trap, but you know, what inspired me to go beyond that is that on the basis of the stipend that I got from a university, I not only visited organized local workshops with scholars in Asia and in South America and also in Africa about their local mobility cultures, but also I could witness the other forms of mobility cultures myself. I remember that in India, for instance, my host brought me to a workshop where they were constructing bodies for buses, aluminum bodies, with their bare hands and bare feet. I also remember visiting a workshop for rickshaws in Calcutta, where people, the rickshaw pullers, were sleeping around on a concrete floor. And in Bangladesh, I visited this notorious beach where the Western world leave behind their big ocean steamers, their ships that are demolished there and recycled, kind of hell on earth. So that is how I realized that if you write the history of those mobilities in those areas, in those countries, you automatically come up with the concept that more or less governed my entire book, which I called Layered Mobility. So while the car indeed spread about the globe, at the same time, underneath that, there was a big substrate, and much more important, especially more important for the majority of people, who developed a totally different form of mobility, like walking, cycling, indeed rickshaw, pulling, all kinds of what Western observers tend to see as backward technology, but I think that's the wrong approach. So you can choose between two types of history writing here. You can say I focus on the innovations, on what you call modernization processes only, and consider that as a kind of end point of a development. And the second approach, and that is the one I chose, is no, you should not focus on that because you miss the majority of the people's form of mobility. You should focus on this double thing, this layeredness, this multimodal mobilities idea, where the majority of people use different types of moving around, whereas there is a new layer superposed upon that, of automobilism, driven by a very specific layer of society.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain the different degrees of mobility development in various parts of the world in the first half of the 20th century. You talk about it nationally, but you also group them regionally. What were some of the differences in these regions, and what were some of the forces that were driving the development of mobility in these various parts of the world during that time?
First of all, I should tell you that the first chapter of what of the book is about kind of rehearsing or retelling the same period that I described in Atlantic automobilism, but then from hopefully from the perspective of the non-Western mobilist or people in general. So the first chapter deals with the period 1895 to 1940 and and introduces, in the first place, new vehicles. You already mentioned the rickshaw, which was very, very important, often pulled by rickshaw pullers, so not the cycle version, but really the hand-pulled rickshaw version, but also one-wheeled barrows in China and head porterage in Africa, and so on. So, first of all, this focusing on other areas in the world resulted in a couple of new vehicles, so to speak, of different vehicles, alternative vehicles, to be dealt with. That's one. And secondly, there is also another point that you find when you go beyond the West, and that is the aspect of migration and refugees. So another form of mobility that is mostly described and analyzed by migration studies and not included in the history of mobility normal. But my point is, and my plea would be, that a true world history of mobility should include migration, even if in terms of mobility it is not very spectacular. Most of this migration takes place on foot first and then by planes or boats, and the car has only a very minor role. So that's a second point that you find as soon as you go beyond the West. And the third point, and that is, I think, the main point, is what I already mentioned, that is this layered mobility where the majority of people drive or move differently than this layer of the middle classes. And one point I would like to emphasize, and that is something that you find in nearly every area beyond the West, and that is what economists have called informal transport. I was really taken aback by the enormous role of informal transport in nearly every country history that I visited. So informal transport is the transport, for instance, where minibuses and jeepneys in Philippines and mini buses in Africa and in many Asian countries are transporting by far the majority of the people in especially urban contexts. But apart from the mini buses, we also have the motorcycle taxis, for instance. Enormous amounts of motorcycle fleets that proliferated after the Second World War, and the details of which I investigate further in the third volume.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It was one of the things I was thinking of as I was reading it was that while you do have this great non-Western perspective, that there's this persistent Western influence. And that was one of the themes I took from your book, not only from that chapter, but from when you were talking about layered development in the second half of the 20th century. But you have with the development of mobility in Africa is of course heavily influenced by the colonial presence. You have in Latin America the shadow of the United States and more broadly Northern America and how this oftentimes has an influence over issues of how mobility develops in these parts of the world during this time.
Yes, that's true. And indeed, you bring me back to the central chapter in this book, which is perhaps a bit surprisingly about the West, what I call the exuberant form of mobility. I describe in great detail how what one could call a zenith of automobilism happened in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, but also in Europe, and to a certain extent in Japan, where something really remarkable happened, because on the one hand, we know all these pictures of American gas guzzlers, and the movies that have been made around it. That's one aspect of this exuberance. The middle class, I haven't mentioned that, but the middle class I analyzed also already in Atlantic Automobilism, that without the middle class, there is no car culture. So the American middle class in the 1950s and 60s started to get bored more or less after a while, after, let's say, the first decade of exuberance. And you see that especially in novels and even pop songs and rock songs that I analyzed especially. What you see is what I called the absent car. I mean, the car in the United States, but also to a certain extent in Europe, became so ubiquitous in the first, let's say, 25 years after the Second World War, that people got used to its exciting aspects. And more or less took it. I'm not saying that they became a utilitarian tool. That's not my point. My point was that what I called the adventure machine before the war became more or less tamed. That was true for especially the masculine part of the middle classes in the West. But at the same time, you see something else coming up. And that is also based on my analysis of a special form of sources, which I used also in Atlantic Automobilism, that is belletristic sources, so novels, poems, songs, games even. And if you analyze these from the mainstream novels a la, John Updike and so on, until the Fast and Furious Hollywood movies, you see this dichotomy coming up in the Western car culture of, on the one hand, this getting used and nearly bored by automobilism, and on the other hand, this enormous, nearly carnivalesque way of dealing with automobilism in movies, for instance. We all know the Mad Max movie is, for instance, a case in point. So what is happening here, I asked myself, and my conclusion is that in general, I think mobility history suffered from a lack of class analysis. And if you bring class back into mobility history, you have to conclude that on the one hand, there is this middle class that more or less invented the adventure machine and more or less got used to it and perhaps even ashamed about it, also because of its devastating fatalities that it caused in the course of history. But on the other hand, you have this popular culture where the car as a kind of very aggressive machine is still celebrated still celebrated in especially movies and television series. And that culture is driven not so much by the upper middle class, I would say, but by the lower middle class and the working class and the classes or groups beneath that, if I may say so. So there is this cleft between two cultures emerging in the Western world has big repercussions for the history of mobility, world mobility later in the century. So my point here is that this double-headed culture was not so much exported as such to the other parts of the world by the West. That's the topic of my last chapter in the book, where I analyze the term of development. What is remarkable then that in this exuberant culture period, also especially in America, in the 60s and 70s, this missionary idea of spreading the car culture came up in the form of development. So the rest of the world should be developed. According to Walt Rostoff, who is famous because of his book Stages of Economic Growth, the process of development should be such that we in the West allow others, backward countries, to develop themselves to our level. That idea was first formulated way before the Second World War, but then got a special Cold War flavor in the era of the presidency of Kennedy, who coined this Alliance for Progress idea, where American companies and the American administration aimed at developing South America to their level, so to speak. And the remarkable thing here is that happened through the proliferation of infrastructure, especially roads, highways. And we see then this process supported by the World Bank and the IMF, by consultants from the West, and even the United Nations in the end, the Peace Corps and so on, to spread this gospel of road building connected to modernization over the world.
That was one of the many things about the book I thought was very educational for me. I mean, until I had read it, I was never aware of this organization called the International Road Federation. And you talk about how it has this influence in terms of lobbying for roads, and you talk about what some might regard as the chicken egg argument of, which comes first, the roads or the cars. And you make it very clear that they're pushing for roads, well before you have the full scale automobilism that comes with the expansion of middle class culture in a lot of the non-Western world after independence.
Yes, that's true. I think that indeed, the conventional story is that first came the car, and then national governments built roads, and that's true in the West for the rest. And it took, let's say, half a century to get what I call the car society on its feet, more or less. But if you look at the other parts in the world, the majority of the people, they experienced the proliferation of car culture totally differently, because it started by building roads way before the breakthrough of national car cultures. Of course, there were cars in China in 1920 or in Chile in the 1930s, but there was no mass automobilism going on, and that only happened after the moment that these highways were built and developed. And the money came from the World Bank and from IMF. And it was considered to be modernization through road building. And we should not forget that it was I'm not claiming there is a conspiracy here, but I was really taken aback by when you read the reports, especially by the World Bank, the eagerness to spread the gospel of the automobile and of roads against trains and against railways. I found that staggering. Most of these people, thought they were doing the best they could do to lift up backward people into the paradise of modernization. But the role of the social scientists and social sciences should not be forgotten here. In my book, I quote a couple of reports that try to describe what they call the mobile personality. So modernization and mobility. Well, I'm not claiming that modernization is mobility. Of course, that is not the case. But up to now, modernization has been analyzed by loads and loads of scholars by leaving mobility out, and that I think is a big error. Modernity, when social scientists analyzed other countries' modernity and modernization, especially for instance in the Middle East, they formulated or they tested in their surveys the fact where the mobile personality, as they called it, emerged in such a country. And the mobile personality was someone who was used or willing to change, read newspapers, and was a kind of replica of, let's say, a Westerner. Only if such a mobile personality was found there, a car society could emerge.
That's one of the things that I found most fascinating about your book, was how you take the notion, the concept of automobilism, and show how through it you can understand so much about the 20th century. Both in the West and in the broader world, how it intersects and intertwines with all these elements of a class, of development, of culture, and it really does show just how profoundly influential the automobile has been throughout all of this, even for people who may never actually have ridden in one.
Yeah, that's true. I think. Going beyond the West for me was a roller coaster, of course, but also it bounces back to the way you describe and analyze Western mobility. That is one of the conclusions of my book, without visiting the global South, you cannot really analyze Western mobility as well. This is, of course, a thesis not by me, but by the Komarov couple. They have said that the West has always used the non-West as a kind of laboratory for its own development. And I knew, of course, that this thesis existed, but I only after I finished the analysis in these two volumes, I really realized that how true that is, that, for instance, this layered mobility, that's a nice example. It's not so that this is the privilege or the monopoly of the non-Western mobility culture. You also see that in the West, only we tend to overlook that, you know. I don't have the figures now in my head, but still a large proportion of families in the West do not own a car. Historians of mobility tend to overlook that. And of course, you know, we know more or less that in big cities like Amsterdam, probably in New York, I don't know about New York, but in Amsterdam, the majority of the trips are not done by car. So, and as we are fast moving into a kind of urbanized world, this phenomenon will expand. So this whole idea of layeredness that we think, that was invented in the global South, also happens and is to be found and should be the basis of analysis of Western mobility. That's one of my main conclusions here, and the second conclusion, I think, is, in general, how does a car culture emerge? And I would say that the word here is middle class. I already in Atlantic Automobilism had a hunch that, for instance, Portugal, before the war, did not have a very broad car culture. And when I investigated that country, I came to the conclusion that was mostly because during the fascist period, the middle class was very small. So the point is that if there is no middle class, or the middle class, for instance, in Indonesia, I described it in my third volume, Indonesia after the Second World War also had a very small middle class, and automobilism did not really emerge. So that is a second conclusion. And one can even make a step further along that line, because in reverse, if a country or if a government wants to stimulate the a local car culture, then it should build a middle class. And we see this process, for instance, happening. We saw it happening in China, where from the, let's say, 1978, when Deng Xiaoping came to power, the central government deliberately started building a middle class by giving judges and other officials suddenly a higher salary, and by stimulating this housing bubble and so on. So you see this process happening in several countries, also in India, but in China it is the most clear, where consciously and very deliberately this middle-class idea, including its possession of cars, can be followed in very great detail.
Well, you've mentioned that you are currently reading the proofs of Pacific automobilism. Do you have a publication date for that book?
Yes, I'm currently doing the proofreading, and if I can do what the publisher asked me to do in terms of keeping my deadline, the book will be published this September. And in fact, it will deal with the results of this transformation, which happened in the first quarter century after the Second World War, and it will deal with the result of this, let's say, pacification or transformation from an Atlantic to a Pacific world culture of the automobile. In the period from 1970 to 2015. And one of the things I'm currently reading, for instance, is a chapter or a section of a chapter about what I speak also already in this book, that is the enormous amount of victims, fatalities that this whole car culture produced during the last century. It's really in the tens of millions of victims. And so we should not forget that, which is a bit underdeveloped in this book, should not forget that automobilism has quite a dark side. Let's keep it at that.
Well, I mean, I do look forward to reading the book when it comes out, especially as, you know, given how you're taking the story and building upon it from these last two books, which make for such fascinating reading. Professor Mohm, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.